Welcome to session one of three on Laudato Si, on care for our common home. The image that I would like us to begin with is the image of Earth from 100 miles out in space. This is an image taken in June of 2015, which is the same month, actually, that the Pope's encyclical became widely available. And before we launch into the text of Laudato Si, and if you haven't already picked up one of the handouts over there on the music stand, please do so, or just raise your hand. We'll make sure. And you should have two items. One is a four-page document, fourfold. You can use that as a folder, in fact, for the other page, which is a one-sheet, two-sided yellow sheet. Okay, let's get ourselves adequately papered. This is designed as a supplement to the book.
We meet again.
Good.
So while we're getting adequately papered, I'd like to see a show of hands of those of you that have a copy of the Pope's encyclical, either in hard copy or on your iPad. Okay, not quite half. And then are there some that have read through the encyclical before the session but may not have their copy with you? Okay. All right. There'll be a test for the rest of you here at the end of our time. So our common home, I'd invite us first to listen to what our common home might be saying to us. And I've got some 3x5 cards that, if that's a help to you, David, maybe you could help me get these out. And I'm going to invite us to consider some reflective questions as we image this. And by the way, everyone should have a little gift, if you will, about a 3-inch by 3-inch take home of this image, so that when we shift the screen to the questions that I invite us to consider, we will have that image before you. Everybody have one of those little 3-inch by 3-inch squares? Okay, all right. No? Yeah. We'll get that to you in a moment. So again, this is session one of Laudato Si. And so question one, I invite us all to ponder a bit. What do you see and hear? As you contemplate that image from within, you might say. What are some sounds? What are some sights as you view our, as you gaze upon our common home? And then, as those of you that have begun to delve into the document, the Pope refers to the imagery of nearly 800 years ago, from the Canticle to the Sun, in which St. Francis, his namesake, describes the earth as, in terms of our sister, and Mother Earth. And so back to the image for just a minute. And so we can perhaps personify the question. What might be our sister, Mother Earth, saying to us? And saying to us as a whole, perhaps, but also to each one of us. And this is a question I invite us to ponder throughout the sessions. So this is not intended to be a quick answer kind of thing, and then we'll be done with it and we'll move on. But I would like the questions to hover over our conversation. And so one more question to ask or to add to the mix, beyond what is our sister Mother Earth saying to us and to each one of us, but what response might be called for from all of us and from us individually? So I offer that as, I'd say, the overall context for our discussion, our engagement with this extraordinary document. So, before we dive into the document itself, I want to invite you to look over the yellow insert, on one side of which you see the entire canticle of the creatures, which is the title that St. Francis gave this this canticle, this little song, and to listen to a portrayal in music and imagery. So what you might choose to do is to follow along on your yellow sheet the words of the canticle that you'll be seeing on the screen, slightly altered. The words are not exactly the same, but pretty close. So this is another way for us to begin to enter into the space of Laudato Si. This is the inspiration for the document that we're about to get into. Thank you. So this then is the context out of which the Pope writes this extraordinary document. For one thing, it's the only document that I know that addresses care for our common home, that has no graphs, no charts, not even any numbers. Did you notice that? Those of you that delved into it a bit? Yes. That in its own right makes it unique, perhaps. And yet, what can this man from Argentina bring to the discussion about care for our common home? The urgency, the gravity of that issue. And some might say, what? The poetry of brother sun, sister moon? Doesn't that reek of naive romanticism? So, we have questions to pose to the Pope. So what you see on the screen right now is a quick look at how we intend to spend our time, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And if you'll now turn to the fourfold for just a minute. This is designed not to convey my understanding of the encyclical, not to put my frame, my outline, my context on it, but to use only the words of the Pope, only the words of the encyclical itself. And so we'll get into the weeds here in just a minute, but if you look at the cover, you see the outline in chapters. At the very top, the Pope devotes 16 paragraphs to setting the stage further. As we know when we read, when we open new books for the first time, there is a preface often by the author that explains, or at least gives some hint. Now, why did the author write this book anyway? Where's the author coming from? So we're going to take a little bit of time to do that. But in our session, we're going to focus mostly in terms of content on chapters 1, 2, 3. So the left-hand side of the cover page is what we're going to take a look at. What's going on with our common home? What contribution from persons of religious conviction, what can that add to the mix? And then third, the Pope's in-depth analysis as to the roots of the, or the human roots of our ecological crisis. And then tomorrow, those that choose to come back, not at this time, but in the afternoon, mid-afternoon, 2:45, we'll take a look at the right half of the encyclical, chapters 4 through 6, which outline a vision of the Pope in terms of a new term to me anyway, and perhaps to many of you, integral ecology. Think of it as ecology, if you have worked with that term, as the relationship of living organisms to their environment. Standard definition in biology and so on, and environmental science. What does it mean to think that concept holistically? And one of the ways in which that is to be thought more broadly is to give equal weight to the human element as well as the natural element. And then this term, a civilization of love. Love understood not as a cuddly emotion, but love in a political sense, a social sense, a sense of justice. And then on Thursday, we will pivot away from the document as the center of our discussion to look particularly at climate change, which the Pope only develops or only devotes four paragraphs out of 246. We are going to look at those in some detail, but also bring in some other voices to the mix. Our aim is to use that as a backdrop for some discussion, some conversation around hope in the midst of our of the science of our unsustainability degradation of the environment. What does it mean to hope? What is the difference between optimism and hope? And are there some other voices besides the Pope's which can help to guide us? So that's sort of a quick overview of what we're going to look at. So let's now turn to the intro for a bit. And since not everybody has had an opportunity to begin to read the encyclical, I've taken the liberty to for us to look at the text of paragraphs 1 and 2, which again are begin to lay out the context of this document. Laudato si mi Signore, praise be to you, my Lord. The words of this beautiful canticle, St. Francis reminds us that our common home is like a sister with whom we share our life and the beautiful mother who opens her arms to embrace us. And now he quotes from the canticle itself, and that's the underlined portion if you're following along on the yellow insert. Praise be to you, my Lord, through our sister Mother Earth, who sustains and governs us and who produces various fruit with colored flowers. So again, he's firmly rooting himself in this document in the poetry, if you will, of the canticle. And he goes on, we'll look at the second paragraph, because he begins to hint at what the underlying cause of our ecological crisis is. This sister now cries out to us because of the harm we have inflicted on her by our irresponsible use and abuse of the goods with which God has endowed her. We have come to see ourselves as her lords and masters, entitled to plunder her at will. Looking more deeply, the violence present in our hearts, wounded by sin, is also reflected in the symptoms of sickness, evident in the soil, in the water, in the air, and in all the forms of life. Well, I'm not going to go through the intro paragraph by paragraph, but now to give you a bird's eye view of what happens next in the paragraphs 3 through 16. He goes on in 3, then, to invoke the words of other popes, earlier popes, in order to place this document in a lineage of declarations, assertions by earlier popes, going back to John the 23rd, so that he doesn't, now we could reflect on the strategy perhaps of the pope, but he sees himself in this document as consistent with the with a long list of affirmations based on Catholic social thought. Moreover, he goes on to clarify in paragraph 3 that this is a letter, that's what encyclical means, it's a letter to every person living on the planet. So this is not a letter just to the faithful, just to Catholics, or Christians, or any particular segment, but to every person living on the planet. And yet this is not intended to be a one-way lecture from, you know, Father Pope, you know, to the unwashed masses. But he emphasizes again and again, but for the first time in very great, this is intended to be a dialogue. And just looking ahead at chapter 5 that we'll delve into a bit on Wednesday, it's dialogue all the way down as you look at the subsections in chapter 5. Dialogue between religion and science, for example. Dialogue between the haves and the have-nots. So this is a man, it's a document who is reaching out not in a spirit of dictating what the result might be. In fact, he has some language here that says, hey, the church is not expert in terms of how exactly we go about this. But he is really trying to set a framework of listening, of dialogue. So, he goes on to talk about the ways in which there is wisdom from outside the church. We need to listen to the voice of science. He also quotes Patriarch Bartholomew, a Greek Orthodox patriarch. So he is reaching out in this broad way to all of us. And then when he reaches paragraph 10, if you're following along the outline at the top of the page on the cover, finally he comes to St. Francis and speaks, I would suggest, to the question that I begin these remarks with. What? Isn't this a bit naive, you know, to invoke the poetry of St. Francis of nearly 800 years ago? And so I'd like to invite you to take a look at the opposite side of the yellow sheet, which prints out paragraph 11. Sometimes, as we know, those of us who read book reviews, you'll see somewhere in the review, well, if you only had, the review was speaking to the reader, if you only have time to read one paragraph out of this book, read this paragraph. So I offer paragraph 11 as a window into this document that offers it's sort of like, in my mind, the rest of the encyclical is a footnote to what he is saying in paragraph 11. So I'm not going to read the entire thing, but just the last few lines that are underlined. So he's referring in the middle of the paragraph to Saint Bonaventure, who is reflecting on what Francis is doing. And basically saying, and yes, he calls every creature, no matter how small, brother or sister. So here's what Pope Francis then says. Such a conviction cannot be written off as naive romanticism. Really? Let's listen. For it affects the choices which determine our behavior. If we approach nature and the environment without the openness to awe and wonder, if we no longer speak the language of fraternity and beauty in our relationship with the world, our attitude will be that of masters, consumers, ruthless exploiters, unable to set limits on their immediate needs. By contrast, if we feel intimately united with all that exists, then sobriety and care will well up spontaneously. The poverty and austerity of St. Francis were no mere veneer of asceticism, but something much more radical, a refusal to turn reality into an object simply to be used and controlled. And we will come back now and then, back to paragraph 11, as we wander through chapters 1-3. But I invite you to hold those thoughts in your mind as we move ahead. But let me pause there and invite some comments. It's a comment you'd like to share in terms of your reflection on gazing on the earth from 100 miles away, or your initial impressions about where St. Francis is coming from.
That picture of the earth from 100 miles away, it looks like this gorgeous, peaceful place that sometimes pictures can be very deceiving. Gorgeous, yes. Peaceful, no.
Okay. Yes, please.
The other thing is that we look at the thing St. Francis was living in this wonderful cultural world where he had all these things, but all the while he was in tension with the other people that were attracted to follow him, and they wanted to make things secure and build and keep consuming. You know, and his whole idea of simplicity was stretched with the people who followed him and who wanted to be monks, who wanted to join him, or wanted to wear the gray habit or the brown habit. I mean, there was that tension in his life. Even when he died, he wanted, you know, to die naked and simply, and the princes of Italy and the church fought to build this great big monument to him, this big cathedral, you know, and pour gold in. And so he was always like losing, you know. I mean, I say, how did he maintain hope?
How did he remain?
Now, and this comes from hundreds of years ago in the past. It's just not a little American thing that we've been talking about. You know, when we look at that, this is not the big problem.
Thank you. Yes. Anyone else care to share at this moment? And we will. Yes, please.
No.
Can everybody hear?
No.
Just a little low.
Okay. I think Francis was a man of his times. He was so simple, so in such a complex way, but very centered on what was really important in his world. And he was very charismatic. He built paintings with him. And gradually he lost control of his order and it seems very similar to our own world. What we thought was is not what we were striving for, is not all that complexity of what we were striving for. And what was Francis striving for? Did he change? Did he mature? How did he change?
I heard you say, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was a man of his time. And perhaps our question is he a man for our time? Are his words relevant? And so again, let that just linger.
But even more important, his experiences were of our time. of our time, of disappointment maybe, of recreating something, but staying steadfast to who we are as a people.
Just a couple more things about the intro before we dive into chapter one. Paragraph, and it relates to the centerfold, as I like to call it, of that fourth page handout that we'll put into a minute. But in paragraph 15, he gives a verbal description of basically chapters 1 through 6. Okay, nothing unusual about that. But in paragraph 16, the paragraph right before he dives into chapter 1, he does something that I've not seen very often in other books. He says, oh, by the way, all the way through this document, I'm going to be coming back to 10 recurring themes. What I've done in the centerfold, if you will, can you all hear me now?
Yeah.
No. What am I going to do? All right, I'll just speak loud. These are Francis's words in the centerfold, pages 2 and 3. Yes. So it's a second way, you might say, for us to engage this document. You're not the linear type, which of course dutifully reads a book, you know, from chapter 1, page 1, all the way through to the end. This is another option that you have by bringing the issues that you already care about to see if any of them match, if any of the 10 themes that Francis deems important line up with the passions that you already bring. For example, let's look at theme. Better get back here so I can do this accurately. Intimate relationship between the poor and the fragility of the planet. Everybody see that? That's the very first theme. And what I've attempted to do with each of the themes is to give you a taste of how Francis himself engages that theme with a line or two. And then if you want to delve into that more, it gives you a section, sometimes 3 or 4 paragraphs, to dig into it more. So think of these as 10 different doors or windows into this document. So I give you permission not to start with chapter 1 and plow through chapter 6. You can also attack it or engage it, let's say, this way. Look at theme B, the conviction that everything in the world is connected, the interrelationship of all things. Not a new idea by any means, of course, but if you're intrigued by, or if you're asking, well, how does Francis deal with this? There are some entry points, we might call them. So I invite you over the next day or two to pick one of these 10, perhaps, and to see where it leads. And those of you who decide to come back tomorrow, I'd like to hear from some of you. Yeah, hey, I picked number, basic theme E, the value proper to each creature. This has to do with the objectification of nature, the loss of biodiversity. Maybe that's a passion that you already come with. Well, what did you learn from delving into 3 or 4 paragraphs? Actually, St. Francis, Pope Francis has 11 paragraphs where he speaks of that issue in depth, and so on. So this is a non-linear option, we could call it. So I invite you to approach it there in that way. OK, let's move then to look briefly at, well, some feedback first. Was that, is that helpful? Does that give you some options that seem to make sense, or at least invite you to do Laudato Si in your own way? Are there some that already in your scan have found a theme or two that you, you know, particularly resonate with? Yes. Please.
Yeah, I'm looking at E, as you just mentioned, the value proper to each creature.
Yes.
And
say more.
I have been reading a lot of the theologian Sally McFaig, and she talks about that as being the notion of teleology, and that, you know, when we take the time to just pay attention in a very simple way, whether it's, you know, watching an ant work, or, you know, just the simple notion or exercise of paying attention, we can begin to have a greater appreciation of the intention and goals even of a being that's not human. And you know, when we read earlier about awe and wonder, I think they don't just happen. I think, you know, when we even just, again, just the notion of paying attention can really help our awe and wonder and appreciation for the goals and intentions of natural beings. That helps our wonder grow. You know, we don't just have wonder. We need to engage and have an encounter with something. So I've just noticed that, I think that it's one thing to read in a book about something, and it's another thing to actually just take the time to observe and be drawn into something else's life besides our own.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that a bit for all of us to think about, so where do we see examples in which the valuing of every creature is not honored? Another way of saying it is, where do you see examples of instrumental use only of other creatures? I worked as a policy analyst in the Colorado Department of Agriculture for nearly 28 years. I worked with ranchers and farmers on natural resource issues, the future of family farms, the depletion of the Ogallala Aquifer, wildlife conflicts between ranchers and environmentalists, and so on. So I have some examples out of that experience. But others, please, where do you see instrumental use of other creatures? David, yes?
I see it in how the mechanical treatment of chickens to get eggs. I mean, they are treated as parts of an organism itself, which is mechanically created, mechanically controlled. Whereas in our acquaintances, we have had a woman who has range-free chickens, and she calls them her sisters.
Really? Great example. Yes.
How about cows that have given special supplements so they can give more milk, but it shortens their life considerably?
Yes.
How about that?
BST? Yes.
CFC.
To get that third milking for the day, I used to work with dairy farmers who are had mixed feelings about adding that third shift to each day.
Well, this is bad to chickens.
Oh.
I have read that we have bred chickens to the point that they have such large breasts because that's what everybody wants.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, turkey. No pun intended. So large that they can't stand up.
Yeah.
They can't.
Sure.
Yep.
Fine.
Yes,
can't copy.
Well, they just, other than the example just showed that we live in a market system, it's all a matter of making money. And values take second place.
And we will touch more on that tomorrow in the Pope's understanding of integral ecology. You look at chapter 4. He actually uses the term environment or economic ecology. And what might that look like? I taught a course at the University of Denver in the spring of last year on ecological economics and human well-being. And we used some of the work of Herman Daly, one of the early writers in the field of ecological economics. So we will come back to the question about the role of money and so on. There was another hand behind, please.
I was thinking of putting fish in huge pens so they're on top of each other for many, many layers, and then that pen breaking and going out into the ocean, wondering what really happened to it.
Something happened.
We will come back to this in chapter one. I want to get a couple things about chapter one, set the context for it, and then I want to come back to delve more deeply into what is this, what are these 10 themes all about, and how does it work to engage this document through these 10 themes. So, very early on in chapter one, the Pope introduces the question. So what's going on? And if you look at the cover for just a minute, you can see the comprehensive outline that the Pope is writing from. Pollution and climate change, issue of water, loss of biodiversity, and on and on. And number five, a global inequality. This is one of the signs that the Pope gives equal emphasis not just to what's going on in the natural environment, but also the social environment. We will see that again and again. So he writes, our goal is not to amass information. So it's not all about coming away from this engagement with this document with more knowledge, although that might be one of the outcomes, or to satisfy curiosity. Well, this man from Argentina, what is he bringing to the conversation? But rather to become painfully aware, to dare to turn what is happening in the world into our own personal suffering. Thus, to discover what each of us can do about it. Back to the question, perhaps, of so what is Sister Mother Earth asking of all of us and of each of us? So that's his context. Let's see what she did too. Yes. Now, I'd like to come back to the centerfold again and to delve a little more deeply into the connection between the environment and the poor. One point before the Pope uses the poetry of the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor to be heard, to be engaged at the same time. So he writes, I'm going to pick one of the categories in chapter one. Again, if you look at the outline, if I just went through, there's about half a dozen different perspectives or angles, if you will, at which he is speaking to the question, so what is happening with our common home? I chose to highlight what is happening to our common home in, if you will, the social sphere, not the natural environment sphere. And he writes, once again, we see the interrelationship, indissoluble interconnection between what's happening to persons and what's happening to the human, the natural environment. The human environment and the natural environment deteriorate together, he says. We cannot adequately combat environmental degradation unless we attend to causes related to human and social degradation. ask for some examples and comments on that here in just a minute. In fact, the deterioration of the environment and of society affects the most vulnerable people on the planet. So that is one way in which we see that first theme coming to light, but also the second theme, the conviction that everything in the world is connected. Comments about the inherent or inseparable connection between the human environment and the natural environment? Maybe signs of where you see it working and maybe where work needs to be done. Barry?
Well, I think that's a very unique line of thought that Pope Francis has about the heavy impact on the poor. That is really, that's what he is all about. In my opinion, he's very Christ-like. The most so of any pope during my lifetime, by far. And I think that's a very Christ-like view that we don't hear that from many people who are concerned about the earth and the environment and recycling, and that whole field is the undue hardship that this is all going to dump upon the poorest and the oppressed amongst us.
And he devotes several paragraphs, as you can see from my little notes. Global inequality is not just a single paragraph, it's five, and he goes on to talk about poor nations. So it's not just individuals.
Well, I think that is real genius, in my opinion.
Yes, please.
So down in, like, I've never been a missing Camarillo down in Southern California, and she was just telling me she was on a run, and she was down for all of our avocados and all this beautiful, lush vegetation comes from, and here comes all of our insecticides, you know, coming into town over the fields, and all the migrant workers not even asked to leave the fields while all of this stuff is getting just, you know, spread over the fields and over the top of their heads because they're this, what, less class of human? I think it's shocking.
Thank you. Okay, just a couple of other ways in which the Pope emphasizes, again, the fragility of the planet and the condition of the poor. Climate change, which are paragraphs 23 through 26. And we will come back to that on Thursday in more detail. But just a quick observation that the Pope's take on a climate change issue is in line with the conviction of 97% of science scientists that have looked at this, that it is a human cause, largely so, and it's happening now. And I have a little segue because this is going to be such a big topic for us on Thursday and so on, but here again is Arson Lyons from the Pope himself. A very solid scientific consensus indicates that we are presently witnessing a disturbing warming of the climatic system. A number of scientific studies indicate that most global warming in recent decades is due to the great concentration of greenhouse gases released mainly as a result of human activity. So that places the Pope squarely on the side of science. Now, just to quickly mention some other voices. Those of you that subscribe to National Geographic may have noted the article in the April issue of this year, Seven Things You Ought to Know About Climate Change. And I'll just hand that around, and don't be, that's available later, but this is a 30-second overview of, okay, what's going on with the climate, according to National Geographic. The world is warming, it's because of us, we're sure, ice is melting fast, weather is getting intense, wildlife is already hurting, we can do something about it. That's it in a nutshell. Complemented with images on each of those points. And then one other voice that some of you may have heard, Naomi Klein, this book came out 3 years ago, This Changes Everything, Capitalism versus the Climate. And what she says here is that climate change is not the only urgent public policy issue we have, but it supercharges each one. So her words, the environmental crisis, if conceived sufficiently broadly, neither trumps nor distracts from our most pressing political and economics causes. It supercharges each one of them with existential urgency. So that is one of the reasons why on Thursday we will give outside of the emphasis on the climate change. And we will hear from other voices besides the quote. But with the tilt, and as I said earlier, toward hope, so what are we going to do about it? And how might we act and persevere without anger, without adding to the anxiety and the fear around that issue? Just to go ahead for just a bit. I'm going to invite some more comment before we move to chapter two, because the quote here, let me just let that hover. It invites more comment about what's happening to our common goal, and say the degree of concern that you have mainly, perhaps, as well as signs of hope. Not too early to get those into the conversation.
Did you want comments? So would you just repeat that again?
Just any comments at this point about the aspect of the way in which the ecological crisis is manifesting itself is of particular concern to you? And if you see some signs of hope, that's great. If you see some signs that we really do need to act and act with all due haste, that would be fine too.
Well, yes. I think the question is if we're past the point where we could do something about it. The hope is that it is encyclical, will have an effect on a lot of people, I guess. But unfortunately, there are people whose fortune depends on them denying it, that are pushing against it. There were people pushed against smoking a long time ago. I remember seeing pictures, articles about doctors recommending Chesterfield cigarettes, okay? But eventually most people gave up smoking, Well, it may be too late for the environment.
Thank you for lifting that up, because on Thursday we're going to take some time as to why there is such opposition to the science of climate change and psychological reasons why we avoid it or minimize it and so on. So,
David, can I insert something? I'm way up high here. Can you see me up here? Mm-hmm. I have a quick response to that ever rising question of, is it too late? E.F. Schumacher said back in the 70s, he said, can we rely on it that a turning about will be accomplished quickly enough to save the modern world? This question is so often asked, yet no matter what the answer, it will mislead. The answer, yes, will lead to complacency. The answer, no, to despair. It is better to simply leave these questions behind us and get down to work.
Yes, please.
Well, I'm just so grateful for that comment. My daughter was in the lecture yesterday, and somebody did comment that it was too late, definitely too late.
Stephen Hawking.
And she came out so sad and upset. Thank you.
And let that continue to hover for us. And we will engage it in a direct way on Thursday, but it's great to raise it now. Is it too late? But let us first listen to what the Pope has to say. And just note for now, it's like I invite you to give voice to what aspect of the environmental crisis, the ecological crisis, both in its human and social forms, particularly grabs you, speaks to you, has your name on it, you might say.
I'm reminded David. Of the parable of the starfish. A person going along the beach saw this person picking up starfish and throwing them out. And he says, there's thousands of them on the beach. Why are you wasting your time? He says, it matters to that starfish. Yes.
Lauren Eisley. Yes. Wonderful story. So we will continue to engage that question. But how about your own story as to, here's one example. Every Monday, 5 o'clock, when I'm in Denver, I'm at the back door of our church. We feed 800 to 1,000 people every Monday in partnership with a nonprofit organization, Grand Street Reach. I and another guy deal with the cardboard and cans coming out the back end of the church. We do not have room in our alley for a recycled dumpster, so we haul it about 8 blocks to a large Episcopal church, which conveniently empties their recycled dumpster 3 times a week. So we show up at 5 o'clock with a load of cardboard and tin cans, and that's what we do. That's not the only thing we do, but that's one of the things. But it's very concrete. And the larger question, of course, is why in a country like ours are there so many hungry people? Why is, according to the survey data, 1 out of every 6 children in America is hungry? That's obscene. So,
and to that, can I just say there is a movement now to take produce from farms that's not perfect. You know, we all want those perfect peaches and pears, and to find ways to use it to feed people. And I find that a system.
Thank you.
If I can make it up here and about me.
Oh.
There's also ways that we as collective bodies of denominations and groups can do things in ways that are unexpected. Like in the 90s, the United Church of Christ commissioned a really, really influential empirical research, bit of empirical research called the Toxic Waste and Race document,
yes.
which related gave empirical data for the reality of toxic waste dumps in the United States and their close proximity to people of color.
Yeah.
And that this is something that was happening over and over again, but nobody was funding the study or giving voice to the study. But the United Church of Christ, one of our sister churches as the ELCA, actually put up money in and kept following it up with further grants. And that was one of the most influential environmental studies of the 90s and early 2000s.
Thank you for lifting that up. Yes. We have time for one or two more. Yeah, there.
As I read the Pope's encyclicals, I have this thought. I was raised Catholic, and so I know from my upbringing, Catholics in the United States don't really pay a whole lot of attention to what's coming out of the Vatican. That's the way it is, folks. And the other thing is, the American Catholic Church is sort of on the outs with Pope Francis. They don't like him. He doesn't particularly like them. And so I'm wondering what effect this encyclical is going to have on
Catholics in the United States?
That's a fair question, but the question I invited people to respond to is your personal dimension of the environmental crisis that grabs you personally in a personal way that you are in engaged with. To use I statements, I guess is what I'm calling it. How would you finish the sentence? I am deeply concerned about the ecological crisis in this way. This is how it manifests itself in my town, my state. I'm asking, does this issue matter to us? And the question of despair, the question of will it matter, of course, hovers over all of us. And we will devote time to that issue. Not only P.F. Schumacher, but Joanna Macy, the author of Active Hope, a book in 2012, Buddhist scholar, eco-philosopher, a woman who's been on the front lines for over 50 years, has much to teach us, as does Pope Francis, about how we maintain our equanimity, our joy. His words for ending the encyclical are, so let us sing as we go forth, facing the struggles and the concern we have about our planet and the joy of our hope. So, and we will talk more.
David, I'm wondering if it would be nice to end with a song, a brief song, given those words. Would you like that?
Yeah, that would be fine. I understood we have till 12:30. Am I wrong?
Oh, yes.
We do. Yeah. 12:45, I think.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't talked about chapter two or three yet, but,
no.
But by all means, I think we need a dose of hope right now.
Yeah.
Yes, and
all
so
right.
We'll do it.
All right, friends, please help me raise up the song. Thank you for your wonderful presentation, David. I know it's just beginning, though. All right, here's the song. The words are, we are a people at the full height of our power. And you might wonder about that. Like, what, really? We're at the full height of our power. It doesn't seem like we're very powerful, but look at everywhere we had to be to get where we are now, we as a people, a human species. And look at all that we're understanding and learning, all that we know about the earth and how we have to care for it in ways that we weren't talking about 70 years ago. So let's just believe this song and know that it's true as we sing. We are a people at the full height of our power. This is the place and now is the hour. Try that. We are a people at the full height of our power. This is the place and now is the hour. Time. We are a people at the full height of our power. This is the place and now is the hour. Yeah, you're getting it. I'm making it a little lower. That's a little high for you. We are a people at the full height of our power. This is the place. That's what we're going to do. And then I'll listen to this. We recognize our sacred worth. And then I'll go. We have the power to transform the earth. So when we sing that part, I'm going to go. We recognize, and then you're going to repeat it. Our sacred. Okay, so you're going to call and response on that. We are a people. Okay, here we go. We are a people. You guys got this. You're going to feel it building. Because when we sing together, we feel ourselves commingling and becoming one body. Let's do that. We go. We are a people at the full height of our power. This is the place and now is the hour. We are a people at the full height of our power. This is the place. Now is the hour. We have the power to transform the
Now, chapter two, which I'm going to do very quickly because I'm going to assign it for homework, in a sense. But the Pope opens this chapter with a rhetorical question. So what is a chapter doing in a document which is addressed to all people of goodwill? What is a chapter doing that deals with the convictions of believers? In other words, what can persons of faith bring to this discussion? After all, if it's a letter to all every person living on the planet, as he says in paragraph 3, so what do people of faith have to say? And he offers six different lenses, six different perspectives in the answer to the question. And rather than working our way through those here as a group, I'm going to invite you to pick one of those between them. Or, well, pick them all, but pick at least one if you're going to be back on Wednesday. And see what the Pope has to offer with that particular lens. And here is a bit more on the context for this chapter. I've already covered the one-liner there from the first paragraph, 62. He then goes on to say, if we are truly concerned to develop an ecology capable of remedying the damage we have done, no branch of the sciences and no form of wisdom can be left out. So this is his openness to wisdom, to insight, not only from science, but also from other religions. But then he goes on to say in the next paragraph, 64, faith convictions can offer Christians and some other believers as well ample motivation to care for nature and for the most vulnerable of their brothers and sisters. In other words, Christianity has something distinctive, something essential to offer as well. And then he proceeds, this is section one. If you look at your outline on the cover page, he's got 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. So he is going to respond in half a dozen ways to the question rhetorically that he lays out at the very beginning of the chapter. So again, I invite you, if you have access to a copy of the encyclical. By the way, I have a version of it on a thumb drive. So if you have a device that can accept a thumb drive, an iPad, or a laptop, or whatever, you're welcome to borrow it between now and then. And I think there's also some hard copies in the bookstore, and I believe there's some hard copies in the library. So anyway, that's all I'm going to say at the moment in chapter two. And we will come back to this chapter on Thursday, when we come back to the question of hope. But right now, I'd like to move to chapter three, which is where the Pope gets at the question of, so deep down, what is the Pope's thinking? What is his articulation as to the depth causes, the human roots, he calls them, of the ecological crisis? And he begins chapter three with these words. I propose that we focus on the dominant technocratic paradigm and the place of human beings and of human action in the world. We go back to paragraph 11, just to repeat the last sentence. This, in a way, is an echo of what he said in paragraph 11. The poverty and austerity, I'm reading from paragraph 11, the poverty and austerity of St. Francis were no mere veneer of asceticism, but something much more radical, a refusal to turn reality into an object simply to be used and controlled. So in this chapter, the heart of his assessment of what is going on, he puts the finger, if you will, on, or points to the technocratic paradigm. But it is important to note that those reviewers and others who only have a superficial knowledge of this document accuse the Pope of being anti-technological. Not so. In the first two paragraphs, he recognizes the positive results of technology. So that's important before he gets to its other side. He writes, humanity has entered a new era in which our technical prowess has brought us to a crossroads. Technology has remedied countless evils which used to harm and limit human beings. How can we not feel gratitude and appreciation for this progress, especially in the fields of medicine, engineering, and communications? So, a happy face there, a little emoji there, just to summarize that. And, but he has more to say. And he goes on to point out that never has humanity had such power over itself. The power is a fundamental characteristic of technology in the Pope's assessment. And yet nothing ensures that it will be used wisely. Are you thinking of examples? Can you write those in a minute? Particularly when we consider how it is currently being used. And then even more forcefully, he says, we stand naked and exposed in the face of our ever-increasing power, lacking the wherewithal to control it. And so there is an ambiguity in the Pope's relationship or understanding of technology. And so I invite comments about how does that play out in your own life, with the life of your family, community, or our society at large. Where do you see this ambiguity, this, yes, on the one side, the undeniable benefits of technology? I'm a cancer survivor and grateful for the skills of medicine and technology used to control it. So, but what about this other side? Maybe to rephrase it, are we controlling technology or is technology controlling us? And where do you see examples of that polarity? Yes, well, Connie.
We have a daughter that's 38 and they had their 20th high school reunion, and hardly anybody came. This is in Yakima, Washington. And it used to be that everybody would go to their reunions, you know.
Yeah.
And so everybody knows what's going on Facebook with everybody. So there isn't any reason to go to the reunions anymore because you already know all the scoop on everybody. So that's kind of good that they know everything that's going on with everybody. But then it's kind of sad for me to think that, you know, because my mother and I'm the same way. When they came back from the reunion, I wanted a scoop on what was going on with all their friends. And the mothers need to have a reunion.
You're going to have to sign up for Facebook.
Great example. We post positive things on Facebook. We rarely post our serious, the things we're going through, the serious things, the hard things, all the time on Facebook. We just put our little weddings and our birthday parties and our, you know, so it's not a real sense of life, right?
Right, it's just a person. She had fun, though, going. She did go.
Okay.
And they all could touch each other and stuff. Few that were there.
This whole business of encountering people on the internet, Facebook if you want to, or whatever, we're missing face-to-face encounters. We're missing being truly human, one to the other. We think we have a relationship with somebody on the internet because we chat with them, but we really don't. We don't really know them. You know, and I think we're being fooled, some of us, by that.
Thank you. David.
Build a little bit on that, as I think Holden is the antithesis of that.
Yeah.
is that we are forced to make new friends. And I think that's wonderful. You, David, we now share not only a name, we share experiences.
Some time ago, a friend sent me a cartoon. I think it was from the New Yorker. So the scene is a restaurant, and there's a family of four that's sitting at a table, and their heads are bowed, and the waiters are talking. Isn't that nice? I seem to be praying. And the other waiter said, no, they're looking at their cell phones. They're texting each other. Anyway. So what does the Pope have some more to say? Well, he gets at the heart. He says it this way, and this is kind of a tough paragraph. But we're also going to look at the centerfold. So this is theme C. So we're going to take two runs at it. Here's the first way in which he articulates the what he calls the technocratic paradigm. The basic problem is the way that humanity has taken up technology and its development according to an undifferentiated and one-dimensional paradigm. That's a mouthful. Paradigm. Think of a pattern, a framework. This paradigm or framework exalts the concept of a subject who, using logical and rational procedures, progressively approaches and gains control over an external object. The subject makes every effort to establish a scientific and experimental method, which in itself is already a technique of possession, mastery, and transformation. And that really echoes, again, that last sentence, I would argue, in paragraph 11 that I read again just a minute ago. Well, that's a mouthful. I think he does it, he says it, at least in ways a little bit more understandable to me. If you look on the major theme C on your handout. And this is one of the 10 themes, the critique of new paradigms and forms of power derived from technology. So this is on the Pope's mind again and again in this document. And so we all can look at it, and I'll just read it in this dim light. The technological paradigm has become so dominant that it would be difficult to do without its resources, and even more difficult to utilize them without being dominated by their internal logic. Technology tends to absorb everything into its ironclad logic, and those who are surrounded with technology, quote, know full well that it moves forward in the final analysis neither for profit nor for the well-being of the human race. And that in its most radical sense, the term power is its motive, a lordship over all. So that is another take at the first convoluted and arcade way of describing it. So comments about that. Do you see technology as And again, he is not demonizing technology itself. Remember, he's critiquing the dominance, almost the exclusive dominance of this paradigm. One example for me, being a policy analyst for the Department of Agriculture, benefit cost analysis is a very common tool used in deciding whether or not to build dams or, you know, power plants. I was having a conversation with one of the engineers up here from the Science and Technology Weekend about benefit cost, and we were talking about the hydropower unit that might be put in to supplement the current one they have, and so on. And we were talking benefit cost analysis. And I was just observing that we need to do all the math. I was a mathematician in my earlier career. And so one of the things that integral economics or ecological economics does is it tries to do all of the math. So often we limit our decision making to what the numbers say. So comments about that, maybe out of your own experience or maybe positive ways in which attempts have been made to incorporate non-monetary or non-market related benefits and costs. Sir?
I think one has to be very careful when you do benefit cost analysis that you count all costs. The internal costs directly related to the production and distribution, but also the external costs shifted to society as a whole. You know, you have a choice to produce something by dumping stuff in the river. It's much cheaper than treating it. So the incentive is to do it the cheapest way to myself, the head of anybody else. Mm-hmm. Because that's really our system. That's basically the market system. You know, you produce it at the least possible cost to whom? To myself, not society. And that's part of the reason why it needs regulation. To incorporate the cost to total society, and of course that's what certain groups are fighting. Because that means they make less money if they have to compensate others who are hurt in the process. And that is very, very, that's the basis of our economic system. You know, Adam Smith's Invisible Hand, every man seeking his self-interest will necessarily lead the best well-being of all. Making your own me, myself, and I the hell with anybody else. But one thing they're leaving out, you don't hear. If you read the Wealth of Nations, you find out that providing there are many sellers and buyers, none which are large enough to influence price, providing there is perfect knowledge, that everybody knows exactly what you're getting into and what the costs and benefits are, and providing there is a moral system. You don't hear about that. You just hear the importance of competition and capitalism.
You were rightly outlining the axioms of neoliberal economics.
I'm familiar with it. That's on my line. That's what I'm doing.
Yes.
You can't help it.
And
we are like that. I'm doing all types of things you have to do.
So back to the paradigm work. So what we are engaged in, not you and I, but I think as a society, is whether or not to have a paradigm shift away from the neoliberal model to, ecological economics, which does recognize these non-market externalities.
Sure.
We can use a little jargon here among our friends. Yeah.
External benefits as well. So that's
yes.
We have
yes.
public education.
It comes both ways.
Benefit to society. By spending money on the kids.
Well, let's
together.
Have lunch together, Wilkins. No, I'm getting interested. I'm conscious of our time. Invite us to end our time to return with me to the back page. These are two prayers that St. Francis ends with, and I'd like to suggest that we read them responsively, kind of a side one and side two, and just to kind of put some of the words of this encyclical into our minds. How about if we divide right here, so if you two in the middle row would decide with this, then the economist friend and we'll be over here. And it says chunked pretty well. We'll read the one on the left because it's shorter, okay? And as St. Francis said, this is a prayer accessible to all persons of faith. So it can be shared in a multi-faith event, for example. So why don't we start, we'll be side one, you be side two, and we'll just kind of go back and forth, and then excuse yourself. All-powerful God, you are present in the whole universe and in the smallest of your creatures. You embrace with your tenderness all that exists.
Pour out upon us the power of your love, that we may protect life and beauty. Fill us with peace, and may live with brothers and sisters, harmony and love.
Oh,
God of the poor, help us to rescue the abandoned and forgotten on this earth, so precious in your eyes. Touch the hearts of those who look only for gain and at the expense of the poor and the earth. Teach us to discover the worth of these things, to be filled with awe and contemplation, to recognize that we are profoundly united with every creature as we journey toward your infinite life.
Let's all read the final.
We thank you for being with us each day. Encourage us, we pray. Struggle for justice, love, and peace.
I look forward to seeing many of you tomorrow, 2:45. Thanks again for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.